This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
When you switch on your computer in the morning, what's the first page you see? For millions, that homepage is Google. And the first thing they notice is the Google Doodle. Now students are being asked to design their own Google Doodle for a nice scholarship.
What Doodle for Google is about is giving students in K through 12 an opportunity to draw their own Google logo.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll get the details of the contest. We'll also hear how budget cutbacks have changed the lives of some teachers in Chicago, attend a training session for emergency room personnel, and spend an academic minute learning about a rare condition that affects a child's coordination. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In just a few years, the word Google has gone from being an obscure word that was only seen on one of those Word of the Day calendars from time to time, to being one of the most used names on one of the most visited websites in the world. There's another term that grew from this, the Google Doodle. And that's something that will mean a big scholarship to one talented and lucky student. Here to talk about the Doodle for Google Scholarship Contest is Ryan Germick, the lead of the Google Doodle team. Ryan, we'll get to this contest in a minute, but first, for the three or four people in the world who don't know, tell us about the Google Doodle.
Sure. So the Google Doodle is one of the special logos that we do on our homepage from time to time, and the homepages around the world. And, I think it was something that the founders did when they went to the Burning Man Festival in Nevada. They put a out-of-office message of sorts, superimposing the Burning Man logo on the Google logo. And it's a tradition we've been keeping ever since, honoring different traditions or celebrations for people's birthdays or holidays, et cetera. And, I guess by this point we've done almost 1,500 of them. And we really try to take advantage of what the internet has to offer and make them as exciting and as fun as possible.
And some of them get pretty elaborate. I mean, I remember for a Star Trek anniversary, you had an animation that was even interactive.
Yeah, over the last few years, we've done more with, like I said, the capabilities of not just an illustration or a photograph or a graphic design, but really thinking about all the things the internet can do. So that's, any kind of interactivity, be it a game or an animation, or even sometimes we've done videos.
So now you're trying to get students involved in this, and I guess this has been an ongoing contest for a few years. Tell us what the contest entails.
Sure. So we're always, looking for ways to kind of celebrate, innovation, technology, and fun. And this is definitely one of the fun celebrations, to be sure. And what Doodle for Google is about is giving students in K through 12 an opportunity to draw their own Google logo. And it's a scholarship competition, so there are prizes to be had as well.
Now, the scholarship, it's pretty heavy. That's a $30,000 scholarship, plus the school gets a technology grant.
That's right. There's a $50,000 technology grant for the school, and, of course, the grand prize winner gets their work on Google for the day.
There's a theme to this year's contest. What is that?
The theme is My Best Day Ever. So we hope that that really opens up the creative possibilities for the participants, and anything that they can think of that would be exciting for them to happen that day, we'd love to see it on a Google Doodle.
It's interesting that it's K through 12. I mean, you would expect that the older kids would have a better shot at this, but I guess we have some pretty imaginative kindergarten students too.
Well, last year's winner was a kid named Dylan. He was 7 from Wisconsin. And, it's not about necessarily technical prowess with a pencil or pen. It's really about communicating something that's, striking and fun. And, we all have that innate artist inside of us, whether we're, 1 or 101. There's no age bias there. It's just about what kind of resonates with the people at Google and also the audience that votes on it.
Now, what type of art are we looking for? Is it something that's actually drawn? Is it something that's computer produced, even some animation? What's being accepted?
Really, anything goes. This year, for the first time, besides entering by mail, you can also enter online. And really, anything you can put onto a Google logo, you're able to do. If you want to use crayons or you want to use spray paint, or you want to use oil paints or pencils or computer, whatever, you go for it and we'll take a look.
This is going through the middle of March. Who's going to be judging it once you get everything in?
So there's a few different rounds of judging. The contest runs until March 22nd. First, we get tens of thousands of entries historically, more than 100,000 last year. And it first goes through many gracious volunteers at Google. And then we have a series of guest judges as well. So folks like Katie Couric and Questlove from the band The Roots and some other really exciting folks are going to be chipping in. And then after the national finalists are selected, there'll be 50, one from each state. We'll then have a public vote online on the website, which is where you can find all these resources. It's, you know, google.com/doodle for Google, and people will be able to pick their favorites from there.
And when do you think when will the actual scholarship and winner be announced?
The winner gets announced in May, and we fly all the national finalists to New York for an award ceremony, and that's when we unveil the grand prize.
We have the grand prize. Are there any other prizes?
Yeah, there's 5 national finalists, and those will all be honored as well.
Okay, that's great. And again, this is google.com/doodle4Google.
That's right.
Ryan Germick is the lead of the Google Doodle team. Again, to learn more about the scholarship contest, go to google.com/doodle4Google. In late 2009, early 2010, the state of Illinois first delayed, then failed to disperse the funding it had allocated to the University of Illinois. In response, the university implemented several cost-cutting measures, including a hiring freeze, salary reductions through furlough days, and cuts to jobs and programs. James Nell and Stephanie Whitaker worked as academic professionals in the political science department at the University of Illinois at Chicago when they were told they would lose their jobs. Academic professionals are lucky because their contracts require they be given a 6 to 12 month grace period before their last day of work. But because they have year-to-year appointments, they're particularly vulnerable to being fired in tough financial times. Independent producer Michelle Boyd crafted this piece as James and Stephanie describe what it was like to lose their jobs and how they fared afterwards.
When I came in 1993, my kids were 1 and 2. I was a working full-time mom, and I always knew that I would do that. But at some point, I realized that my family needed me more than we had to have that second paycheck. So I sort of cut my ties with the university for about 6 months before I said, oh, this staying at home stuff is hard. And I actually came back in the temp pool and landed this role in political science 7 years ago.
At first I worked in financial aid and then as sort of a junior academic advisor. That was great until the recession of 2002. The university had a budget problem, and many of us in the College of Medicine received T contracts. I was one of them. I was out of work for about a week before I was hired by the political science department to be their graduate advisor.
I didn't want to just work with kids who aren't struggling for something, who aren't, you know, the first in their families to go to college. And I can get that here.
Oh, I felt that I was very lucky and had found my niche. It was a position that I kind of imagined that I might retire in.
I had been following news reports so closely, and every time I turn on the news, another company was letting 2,000 employees go.
So I could foresee that this was becoming an increasing probability that I would go through this difficult thing for a second time.
And then we started to hear rumblings about administrative cuts.
It's kind of like being an insect and seeing the car windshield coming at you in slow motion.
And then it was not just program cuts, it became human resource cuts, you know, people.
My department head on Friday called the 4 staff members together, said, we're going to have a meeting on Monday at 10. And he didn't smile. You pretty much know what that's about. Not a fun weekend.
Fast forward that now about 3-4 days. Now it's Monday, the week of Thanksgiving, and we're all called in a meeting. And we're told all of the administrative staff in 4 areas of social science will lose their jobs.
The positions were going to be eliminated, and a pod would be created with five low-wage positions and perhaps a supervisor.
While I was thinking, wow, really? After all these years, I got to find something else. How do I remake myself? You know, you go through, you know, let me start reading my Essence magazines and figure out what new outfits I need. I need to get to the health club and lose about 15 pounds so I can get this new look about me.
The harder moments came, you know, earlier and later. These are the times when you stop, when things slow down and you have a chance to consider, you know, well, what is my future? Am I going to live under a bridge? How ugly is this going to get? Then, you know, those are the most difficult moments for sure.
But what I began to think over the next 30 days or so was, how did this happen to the departments and the department not have a say in it? And I think it was right after that I sent a note to my faculty that said, I hear you guys discuss things all day long on Academy about, you know, telephone changes at the university, parking changes at the university, but all the administrative staff is let go, and I don't hear anything. Right after that, I think the faculty began to rally.
I talked to my state senator. I talked to my state representative. I'm losing my job because of the Illinois state budget deficit, I think was the main message. Are you going to support a revenue increase?
After the faculty rallied, and they rallied, and they rallied hard, and they marched on Springfield, and they marched on the State of Illinois building downtown, you know, what ultimately happened was only two of us were let go.
And there was no pod, and the salaries were retained, and it was just in the four-person department, we were going down to two.
And even that was very uneasy in the department.
Well, I applied for over maybe 30, 35 different positions. A third to a half were at UIC. I hadn't given up on the place yet.
I've had my T contract rescinded, and I am glad that I still have my job.
I found another position in the 11th hour in November. The physics department hired me.
We never told the boys about my T contract. I didn't want to share it and have it be their fear. Oh my God, our mom's going to lose her job. Are we going to lose our house? That kind of thing.
My colleagues at Wayne State, they're still in the same jobs that they were, or better. They have never heard of a T contract. They only get fired for cause, and none of them have ever been fired for cause. And they have a lot of confidence as a professional. And I feel like I'm kind of wounded but on the mend. And it'll take some time to regain the sense of confidence and security that most people have.
Those people who have said to me, oh, you should just be lucky you have a job. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I'm grateful for that. But I have not lost the impact of what happens when someone says, your life is going to change. In a year, you're going to be gone.
This piece was produced by Michelle Boyd as part of the series Meet the Budget Cuts, a multimedia project that explores the human impact of state budget cuts. Learn more at meetthebudgetcuts.weebly.com. Still to come, an emergency room becomes a classroom. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. We can handle it. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1167. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Many medical schools use lifelike dolls and dummies to simulate real patients in emergency conditions. Some of these sim patients can be remarkable. I attended one of these simulations at Seattle Children's Hospital a couple of years ago, and here's what it sounded like.
What's going on?
He was fine. He was having a bottle, and then he went in the V-fib.
Do we have?
We have a right PIV over here.
We
in the
have
arm.
A sat probe that's on.
Okay, do we have any sats? Do we have
no
a pulse?
Sats.
If you walked into this simulated emergency room situation and didn't know it was a simulation, your first instinct would probably be to panic. Your next would be to admire the calm professionalism of the emergency care personnel. During the simulated emergency, the condition of a 3-month-old baby quickly deteriorated until its heart stopped. Training sessions such as these are an important part of keeping emergency personnel prepared, as we used to say on the radio, in case this had been an actual emergency. During the simulation, all members of the Seattle Children's Emergency Blue Team methodically went through a checklist of tests and observations as the young patient's condition deteriorated.
The concept of using simulation in medicine came out of the airline industry flight trainers.
Dr. Daniel Rubens is an anesthesiologist at Seattle Children's Hospital and is the medical director of the simulation program.
In terms of having a checklist for medical things, that's pretty new. It's because, you know, if you go back 5-10 years ago, it used to be, you know, the good doctor would stand there and go, I wonder what's going on here. And we still find that today is that, you know, a baby goes into a crisis, you can have 4 doctors standing there. They're all highly trained and they're trying to figure out what's going on. But that's not what the baby needs. The baby needs ABC, airway, breathing, circulation. So we have to pull them back to this basic protocol or checklist.
Another important part of the training session was making sure every person in the room knew their role in the operation.
For the hospital, there's a code team 24 hours a day. So that code team runs pretty much as they did with a cart and with their bits. And they come from certain areas of the hospital, mostly from intensive care. So you'd have an anesthesiologist that would take the airway role. You'd have 2 intensive care nurses that would take the medication role or the CPR role. The person doing chest compressions is a single role. And so all those people come as that team and respond around the hospital so that you've got that team response and they will work together and, you know, and then they follow that sort of checklist.
The blue team leader is the calm, authoritative voice you hear the most during the simulation. Dr. Jennifer Reed is an attending physician at Seattle Children's and played that role as the team leader in the simulation I watched. She told me that as an ER attending physician, it's a role she plays very often in real life. During the simulation, everyone on the resuscitation team worked together like a well-oiled machine. I asked her if that was like real life.
We were trying to show you our best example. So this is the ideal of how we would like things to go. And that's exactly why we do simulated resuscitations. Our goal is to have every resuscitation run smoothly and sort of pretty much the way we modeled. And that's why it takes practice. Fortunately in pediatrics, resuscitations are a rare event. But if you don't practice it and practice going through all the steps, then when it actually happens, you're not going to be prepared to do everything in a timely, organized fashion.
We've often talked about communication between doctors and patients. Here it seems like you're practicing communication between doctor and doctor.
Here we're practicing communication between everybody involved in the team. So it's between the doctor, every doctor on the team, the nurses on the team, the respiratory therapists on the team, and the family as well. We believe that it's important for everybody to be involved and up to date as far as where things are at in a patient's care.
When you come into a simulation like this, do you know what's going to happen?
No. So the goal during a simulation, honestly, is to have a whole group of people there who don't know what's going to happen and then to have to respond to it as they would in real life as sort of the patient's condition is evolving. And we're able with the simulation to then have the simulator respond to what the team is doing, so as it would in real life.
After the simulation, there was an evaluation. The entire team was assembled and the performances reviewed. Dr. Rubin stressed that they're not looking for perfection.
The goal of this is is to accept human error, that especially in this highly strung situation, human error will occur, and it does occur. And this has been very difficult in medicine to accept that. So, you know, we're human, we make mistakes. So that's why we need to practice it. So the goal of this is not to do it perfectly. The goal of this is to make mistakes. And this is the place to make them, but not on in a real situation.
In the center of all this activity was the patient during this little simulation, an extremely lifelike mannequin of a three-month-old child called the Sim Baby, which Dr. Rubens had a hand in designing. Inside its cute exterior is sophisticated circuitry controlled by a laptop computer that creates a realistic pulse in the child's arm, causes the chest to rise and fall as it breathes, exhaling carbon dioxide. It cries, it pulls its arm away when you shoot an IV in it, gasps, and even makes heart, lung, and bowel sounds. I noticed after the simulation was over and we were just talking to the participants that the Sim Baby was just lying there on the OR table, still breathing. The only thing the Sim Baby didn't have that the real three-month-old would is a name. The company that manufactures Sim Baby is the same one that introduced Resusa Annie back in 1960. It's hoping it does for childhood emergency medicine what Annie did for EMTs around the world. There's a rare condition that strikes children that really has no training simulation. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. If you've spent much time around small children, you are probably accustomed to the occasional spill, fall, or other mess-inducing mishaps. But as Priscilla Casola, assistant professor of kinesiology at the University of Texas at Arlington, reveals, a small percentage of children face a more serious obstacle when developing their motor skills.
At least 6% of the American school-age population, some 3 million children, suffers from a condition called developmental coordination disorder, or DCD. The disorder is characterized by marked impairments in balance, fine motor, and visual motor skills. Those difficulties have been associated with poor mental health, emotional, and behavioral issues. And I'm very interested in why this lack of motor coordination occurs. The difficulties appear to be caused by impairments in the frontal parietal system, or the frontal and middle part of the brain. This results in poor integration between planning, executing, and using feedback during motor actions. Brain messages are not accurately transmitted to the body, and vice versa. In my lab, we have been exploring how children with DCD estimate and visualize actions when they're using an implement, such as using a pencil to write. We found that children with DCD seem to be less accurate than typically developing children when estimating their reach ability using an implement, and the length of that implement is also important. For example, typically developing children are just as good when estimating their reach, whether they are using their hand, a 20, or a 40-centimeter stick. But children with DCD were less accurate when estimating reach using the 20-centimeter stick than just with their hands, and even less accurate when they use the 40-centimeter stick. This ongoing investigation has already given us an exciting window into how children with DCD process information. Knowing the conditions under which movement planning is impaired can help us develop effective intervention strategies.
That was Priscilla Casola of the University of Texas at Arlington. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.